Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, as I was preparing to welcome our guest this morning, I was thinking back to when many, many years ago, we had some folks on from the state of Connecticut that were beginning the yeoman's task of trying to build a resource for companies as they saw the approach of what we now sort of refer to as the opioid epidemic. I'm talking almost a decade ago when folks were seeing the tsunami coming and working to create situations and resources for workplaces and bosses and managers to be able to support and help individuals who were going through recovery or addiction. And here we are nearly a decade later, and I'm so pleased to have seen the movement of recovery-friendly communities and especially recovery-friendly workplaces take hold, particularly with an organization that I have been a great fan and supporter of for way more than a decade. And I'm talking about the Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership, RYASAP. We'll get right into our discussion with them right after we remind you that you don't want to miss the next Lunch and Learn brought to you by Connecticut's Office of the Healthcare Advocate. It's happening May 21st at noon, and in just about 30 minutes, this virtual gathering promises to deliver a critical update of the legislative actions from this year's session, which just ended during the week on May 8th. If you're concerned about your family, healthcare plan, or how the state's policies will affect you, your business, or employer, don't miss this Lunch and Learn. To participate, you can go to ct.gov/OHA, and to view previous sessions and Lunch and Learn activities, go to YouTube and search for Lunch and Learn with OHA. Now let's turn back to our conversation with a couple of great folks from RYASAP. I also refer to them as the hub to when I'm telling people about them, because that's a part of their website handle. So I'm so pleased to welcome a couple of folks whose passion centers on recovery-friendly workplaces. Kirsten Nauman is with us. She's treasurer of the Connecticut Association of Prevention Professionals and co-chair of Connecticut SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana. Jacqueline Kalayag joined the Hub in late February as a program coordinator. She actually comes from a background in East Asian studies. She was a student at Wesleyan University here in Connecticut. She also has a Master of Science from Columbia a School of Journalism, and she's worked for 25 years as a television news producer and entertainment reporter in U.S. and Japan, and she put her career on hold to support a family member through a struggle with substance use disorder and other behavioral health issues, an ideal candidate for RYASAP. We thank you both for joining us today. So let's talk about RYASAP first, the jurisdictions that you serve and what the organization is all about. Kirsten, let's kick it off with you.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm happy to be here. RYASAP, as you said, the Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership, has served the greater Bridgeport community since 1985. RYASAP works to ensure really the safe and healthy development of youth, young adults, and their families. And they go about that in several ways. We actively engage all sectors of the community, and we work on a variety of issues, including things like restorative justice, gang and gun violence, and the coordination of behavioral health initiatives. And that's really where the Hub comes in. You had mentioned the Hub in your introduction. Mm-hmm. That is a division of RYASAP. It's the prevention division of RYASAP. It's the Regional Behavioral Health Action Organization for Region 1, which is the 14 towns between Greenwich and Stratford in southwestern Connecticut. And it is the hub that coordinates the recovery-friendly workplace initiative.
Well, we're doubly pleased to have this program on as we are into the first full weekend of Mental Health Month here in May. Your organization and your team is going to play an even more important role, not just doing the day-to-day work that you do, but spending all that extra time promoting mental health awareness and destigmatization and advocacy. So you guys must be pretty busy over there right now, huh?
Absolutely. We're always busy, but you're right. Mental Health Awareness Month is certainly a time of year where we really try to step up our efforts, especially at the Hub, being the prevention arm of recovery of RISAP. So we're excited to do it. It's great to have an opportunity to really get the message out there that substance use and mental health is something that affects all of us. And unfortunately, there is still stigma around that. And that's why something like a recovery-friendly workplace initiative becomes even more important, because it allows us to talk to organizations about that stigma and ways that they can help to reduce it.
Well, let's talk about the movement of recovery friendly, both in terms of community and workplace. Now, forgive me if I don't have the information right, but RISAP also does have great interest in recovery friendly community initiatives as well, right?
Yeah, so there's several different initiatives that the state and actually that are even national initiatives. There are recovery-friendly communities, there's recovery-friendly workplaces, there are recovery-friendly campuses. Essentially, they all are working towards the same end goal, which is to allow people who are living with substance use disorder or with certain mental health conditions to live active, engaged lives within their communities.
So in terms of recovery-friendly workplaces, certainly, there's got to be a lot of challenges in smaller businesses when you have a workforce of five and one of those individuals is suddenly takes the initiative to get control of their addiction and to engage in a recovery program, you know, that takes away one-fifth of the workforce. And then you have massive corporations and huge businesses, manufacturing, retail, what have you, where they may not only have the necessary workforce to be able to lessen the burden on everyone else in the operation when an individual goes into recovery. But they also, unlike many small businesses, actually have a human resources department at hand that can offer a lot of resources and assistance to these individuals in terms of getting them tracked to the help that they need. Let's first talk about how your organization helps to coordinate with the big businesses that already have a sort of a team in place in-house to be able to sort of, triage and support individuals who step up and come to them who want to engage in recovery.
Sure, I can jump on that. This is Jacqueline. Thank you, John, for having us. Well, the thing is, with big corporations like that and human resources, sometimes it's actually not as easy to go and be open about any issues you have. And that's where the recovery-friendly workplace comes in, because part of being a recovery-friendly workplace means you actually have someone on site who is a peer champion. And that's an ally. It's somebody who is not necessarily in recovery, but has a grasp of what substance use disorder is and what recovery means. And when we talk with corporations about choosing a peer champion, we say, you know, think about somebody in the company who is the person that people naturally gravitate to after the weekend to talk about their good things and their bad things. And what's nice about the peer champion is we offer the peer champion trainings and resources to be able to have that on hand when someone does come and open up to them about their issues, whether it be substance use or mental health.
And when it comes to getting a foot in the door for these businesses, is it easier today to do than maybe it even was a year ago, because human resource professionals are actually kind of circling their wagons around the movement a little bit more because it has become so widespread and formalized?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is, one in 12 Americans is living with a mental health concern, one in 25 with a serious mental health concern. 75% of people who have an untreated substance use disorder are actually part of the workplace. So it's something you can't really ignore. And if you want to hold on to employees or attract employees, you have to have kind of an open mind and a compassionate attitude toward behavioral health concerns.
So you folks promote the Connecticut Department of Public Health's five key principles to guide the development of dealing with substance abuse disorder, substance use disorder in the workplace. Can one of you kind of review those 5 points and let us know, in your view, how they're succeeding with the clients that you're dealing with?
I think that it's important here that we note that a recovery-friendly workplace wouldn't be required to offer any sort of treatment or clinical help to an employee. So although we can certainly speak to that, I think that I wouldn't want employers to hesitate to become a recovery-friendly workplace because they feel that there's a burden that they have to provide some sort of on-site treatment for employees who might be struggling. Instead, a peer champion would be someone who would be a friendly face and someone that a person who was suffering either themselves or even a family member from some sort of behavioral health issue or crisis would be able to go to that person without fear of stigma or losing their job.
Incorporating it into their kind of corporate or company being in and of itself has to be a great, if not relief, it has to be a great motivator for the workforce. It certainly can make everyone at a company feel better about the place that they work.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that's wonderful about what we've seen about a recovery-friendly workplace is when you have a compassionate and you foster a good environment like that, employee turnover is much less. Absenteeism is less. Presenteeism is less. And presenteeism is, I will give you an example, when I was struggling with my family member who was dealing with substance use issues, it wasn't really the easiest thing for me to be at work and concentrate on work. If my workplace had been a family recovery-friendly workplace, I would have been able to go to my peer champion and say, look, I have to take a couple of days off because I'm trying to get my son into treatment. And that person could have helped me work out some kind of plan. And that's what's lovely about the recovery-friendly workplace is there is a person you can go to, and you know that the attitude is going to be welcoming and understanding.
Well, we talked a little bit about dealing with the big corporations that have their own HR department also provide hopefully some guidance and support for any individual that may step up wanting to enter recovery or to support a family member of an individual coping with a substance use disorder. But you also mentioned that in some respects, it's easier to get your foot in the door and get smaller companies to step up and identify themselves as recovery-friendly workplaces. How does the small company dynamic differ?
I think in some ways it's easier because a small company is already like a family, and there already is that understanding, compassion, and openness. And especially with places like spas and people that provide services for mental health and overall well-being, those places have been very receptive and eager to become recovery-friendly workplaces.
And I guess no matter what the size of the company is, one of the things that might help them to embrace this movement more easily is when they start learning about the more kind of global benefits. No, as I said, no matter what size they are, there are a number of reasons to become a recovery-friendly workplace. Speaking to managers and owners and operators out there, let's enlighten them about some of the most important reasons beyond ensuring that their workforce is as healthy and happy as they can be.
Sure. I think there's so many benefits to becoming a recovery-friendly workplace. As Jacqueline mentioned earlier, you're making an explicit declaration to your workforce that you really value their overall well-being. You're going to see that well-being continue to really just flourish. You're going to see employees who want to remain productive employees for you. Your retention will increase. Overall engagement will increase. Your absenteeism will go down. Your presenteeism will go down. And in addition, you're proactively addressing issues before they become a crisis. And companies that are recovery friendly report that they have huge reductions in their overall healthcare costs and huge reductions in employee turnover. So there's really a lot of great benefits, reasons why it makes sense, whether you're a large corporation or a small, to really change your work culture so that you're supporting the overall well-being, the physical and mental health of your employees.
So
I also just wanted
for
construction companies also, decrease in accidents on site is also recognized.
Excellent.
And experienced by people, by companies that are recovery friendly workplaces.
Right. So there, and so that does speak to one of the several economic benefits, a much safer work environment, which then impacts everything from workmen's compensation contributions to insurance savings and just the general reputation of the company and the places that they work. So that's great. In the last 3 minutes or so that I have with you guys, can we now just turn to two points of view? One, from a coworker who learns that they have a colleague who is either coping with a substance use disorder or has entered recovery. How does the recovery-friendly workplace movement counsel the peer-to-peer engagement in a recovery-friendly workplace?
So part of the training for the peer... Go ahead, Kirsten.
Go ahead.
Okay. So part of the training that we offer to the peer champions is one of the things is language matters, and that is just kind of trying to create the language around substance use disorder and recovery that makes it friendly, that makes it non-judgmental. We also offer trainings in Narcan, and which, you know, heaven forbid, there's an overdose on site. An employee would be trained in how to use Narcan to reverse that overdose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about in terms of the company owner, the foreman, the manager, the executive who suspects or has evidence to believe that they have a member of their workforce who is either experiencing a substance use disorder or who may approach them admitting it and hoping to enter some sort of recovery situation? What are a couple of the best ways for a superior or a manager to step off on the right foot when that news comes to them?
I often like to make the comparison to an employee coming to you and saying, I just found out that I have cancer. I am guessing that most employers out there, if I were to go to them and say, I have cancer, their first reaction would be, that's terrible, and what can I do to help you? And if I said, I'm not sure, but, you know, I might be missing some work for treatment, it's all up in the air right now, I'm pretty sure that my employer would say, you take the time you need. You need to take care of yourself, and you need to get yourself well. And you're not going to do me any good until you are well yourself. What Recovery Friendly Workplace is trying to do is use that same model. So if I were to go to my employer and say, I'm really struggling with depression and I need to take some time, or someone in my family has substance use disorder and I just want to let you know that my work might suffer from it, but I want to be open with you so you know what's going on. I would hope that the employer then, just like when I approached them with cancer, would say, you take the time you need. You need to heal. Your family needs to heal. After that, we can talk. You are no good to me until you have healed yourself. So it's really just changing an overall culture so that people feel that they are really valued by their employee, by their employer, and so that the employer is truly valuing the full mental and physical health of their employees.
Very good. We'll leave it there. Great information this morning. Great resources from our friends at RIASAP. I'm talking about the Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership. Consider your business and consider it a member, becoming a member of the Recovery Friendly Workplace Initiative. It can deliver better morale, better bottom line performance, happier, healthier, loyal, long-term employees. It's good economic policy, it's good HR practice, and good healthcare policy. And the folks at RIASAP can help you achieve it. They have resources, as you heard from our guests this morning, Kirsten Naumann and Jacqueline Kalayak. And if you'd like to know more, you can start at their website, which is thehubct.org. Put a slash after that and put in RFW for Recovery Friendly Workplace, and it'll bring you to the splash page where you can start getting your company in on this initiative. Guys, thank you so much this morning for your resources, and I'll look forward to talking with you again. So this is an interview I look forward to all year, and whether the director or leader of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas has been with me on the program before, or if they never have, it's always something to look forward to, as is the festival, which is turning 29 this year, going to be looking into their 30s, and it's probably been about 29 years since I've been trying to feature this incredible, globally focused event here on the award-winning For the People. Shelley Kiala is with us. She is the executive director of this year's festival, which is as I said, turning 29 this year, and they are announcing their summer lineup with new ideas and a new approach to take festival goers on an unforgettable journey between June 14th and June 29th. You may have read about the festival recently in the New York Times. Shelley, you're making headlines. Now it's time to make some radio.
I'll take it. All the media. We'll take all the media.
All right.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Well, quickly introduce yourself to all the folks listening. What's your background and what brings you here to help our festival in New Haven?
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me today. So I've been in New Haven actually for almost 4 years, which because I moved in the middle of the pandemic, a lot of people thought I think I just arrived. I've actually been here since 2020.
Oh, okay.
I was born and raised in the Milwaukee metro area. I performed when I was a young person, did theater, musical theater, sang, danced, and then went to school at the U of M, University of Minnesota Twin Cities, where I studied arts in different cultural contexts. And I was really interested in the way that arts can do community building, the way that performing arts in particular can be a voice for social change. And I worked at a performing arts center in St. Paul, Minnesota for 17 years, the Ordway, where I led the programming department, originally education and community engagement. And then I grew into a vice presidential role there, leading programming, education, and engagement. So the move to New Haven felt like a really natural extension of that work. Many of the artists that had performed at the festival were artists that I had worked with. And the connection, the intentional connection to community without being afraid of having that connection mean that we also invite people in from around the world to not just perform here, but also to be in relationship with us. So those are the things that really drew me to Arts and Ideas.
Yeah. Well, speaking of community building, I mean, the main event is June 14th through the 29th, but the festival and your office has been interacting on community events for a little while now, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, our season really starts in January. I would say we have a fellowship program of high school students that take classes at Gateway Community College. We have 22 of them this year. And every week starting in January, they've been learning about what it means to put on a festival. What is arts administration? What are the skill sets you need to have? So after that, then we had a great event called the Visionary Leadership Evening with an artist, Sona Jobarte, at the Schwarzman Center at Yale in April. Mm. We've been exploring themes of migration through the Big Read in a book called The Best We Could Do, and doing film screenings and conversations in partnership with the New Haven Free Public Library. And we have neighborhood festivals all this month. Every single weekend, we're going to be at a different city inside, or a different part of the city in New Haven, celebrating and creating wonderful events with our neighborhood festival partners.
Man, those little village districts really gives you an opportunity to bring uniquely flavored, but perhaps, you know, audience favorites, or at least flavored in the theme of what the demographic within those neighborhoods enjoy most.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it really brings us into a position of being able to create with them, right? Mm. Not for them, but with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the most fun things to do, I think, in the arts.
And really fulfills that that community building track, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of quick hit questions. Obviously, in 29 years, the International Festival of Arts and Ideas has put New Haven and Connecticut on the map in a big way, in some of the smallest countries and locations on the planet. How far flung are our farthest guests going to be traveling to New Haven this year? Where did you recruit from for acts that are coming a great distance?
What a great question. So the last Friday of the festival on the New Haven Green, that's going to be the 28th, we have the fabulous Dobe Nahare, who is a wonderful vocalist, drummer, percussionist, and storyteller, really, from Sierra Leone. Mm. And I met her when I was at the Ordway. We brought her in for a global music series we were doing. She's been all over the world. She does a lot of the jazz festivals internationally, and she'll be for free performing on the New Haven Green, which is very exciting. We also have this wonderful group I've been watching for a while, and I've never been able to present. We got them this year, Daka Braka. They are Ukrainian folk fusion group. And they have been performing all over the world the last several years, really in support, both to bring their own unique sound to audiences and also in support of the Ukrainian people who are, of course, going through a continued invasion right now. So they'll be playing. They just won the Shevchenko National Prize. Yeah, and their sound, it's quite unique. I mean, you really can hear an Eastern European vibe, but it's connected to electronic music as well, which is a lot of fun.
And that's that's a ticketed event?
No, that's free.
Oh,
that's free.
Great.
It's on the green, yeah, on June 20th.
Yay.
We've got a group from Alaska that is an Inuit soul group, Pamua, who is, they represent Alaska's indigenous culture, and they'll be also free on the green from 7 to 8:30 on the 23rd. And then, of course, Montreal is well represented. We have a fantastic group called Cecilia, who's going to be playing on the green for free doing Celtic music. There's a Celtic community in Montreal on the first Sunday on Father's Day, the 16th. And then inside Seven Fingers Dual Reality, they're doing a circus show that is based on the narrative of Romeo and Juliet. And it's going to be fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, as you approach the summit of the 30th year of the festival in 2025, I understand you have decided to start this year with a new approach featuring multi-day summits. Can we talk or at least start talking a little bit about that before we take a quick break?
Yeah. The ideas programs. So rather than have, you know, a smattering of ideas topics throughout the week, and we do have some of those, we're really taking these each Saturday of the festival to focus on a topic. And so the first Saturday will be focused on environmental voices. The second, and, you know, listening to the wisdom of people who have been thinking and working about how we can do better in terms of the environment with us. And then the second Saturday, we're talking about how we live. What does it mean to have a really fulfilled, rich life? And how do we self-define that? And so we're going to have a lot of speakers talking about that topic. The final day, which is the 29th, we will be focusing on cultural resilience and connections in the arts, and speaking with a lot of Native American leaders and voices, including the chair of the National Endowment for Humanities, Shelley Lowe.
That's wonderful. It's almost like you're doing like a conference approach instead of catching whatever expert or authority you can and trying to plug them in as they're going between somewhere else and with a stop in New Haven and then on to the next stop. You're sort of converging all the experts in and around a subject on a specific day.
Yeah, that's right. That absolutely. That's the approach. And, you know, then as a result, we get to have a deep conversation as a community around these topics, which is enriching.
Very good. Shelley Kiala is with us. She is the executive director of the 29th, New Haven International Festival of Arts and Ideas. And we are going to talk a lot more about what you can expect of the festival. We hope you'll come. Folks are coming from all over the world. Why not join them here in New Haven for some fantastic cultural arts experiences? By the way, while you're here, we've got some good pizza. Maybe stop at one of our other great restaurants or other venues. But in the meantime, we just want to let you know a little bit before the festival kicks off, our friends at Westport Pride are inviting allies and supporters to march with them at 9 a.m. on May 27th in the Westport Memorial Parade. You know, until the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, thousands of LGBTQ+ individuals gave their lives in silence serving our country. So come celebrate their dedication to shared values and stand with Westport Pride for the first time in Westport's history and remember their fallen LGBTQ+ heroes. Or if you can't make the parade, plan to be at the organization's Westport Pride celebration. That's happening on June 2nd from 12 to 4 on the Jessup Green in Westport. Or check out one of their other activities. You can get all the details on this and other Pride Month events by visiting westportpride.org. So, Shelley, thank you again for joining us. Shelley Kiala with us, director of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. I finally got the name right.
Good job.
So, some big names are coming as well within their worlds of fame and followers. Numerous Grammy-nominated and award-winning artists. Hit us with a couple that you think will really be great draws, and do remind us if those particular shows are ticketed or no cost.
Absolutely. So the most Grammy award winning artist that's coming this year is Samara Joy. She's a jazz singer. She has won two Grammy awards, and she's only in her early 20s. So just wait until she gets a little bit further in her life. She's going to be performing at College Street Music Hall. She's been selling out venues all over the country and internationally. That is a ticketed show on June 26th at 8 o'clock. And tickets are selling fast. So if you're interested in Samara Joy, my suggestion is to check that out and get your tickets soon.
Very good.
And then we have on free on the outdoor stages, the fabulous Stokely Williams. He's going to be singing on the 21st of June, and Grammy award-winning artist as well. He used to be the front man of Mint Condition, which was a really well-known R&B act in the 90s, and has been going solo since then. He's actually starring in the Rick James musical. If you've been watching that, that's kind of hitting the East Coast right now. He is that person. You can see him for free on the green. And we also have Brazilian bossa nova artist Caro Pierotto. She's a Grammy Award nominee. She will be on the New Haven Green on Thursday, June 27th at 7:30 p.m. for free.
Very good. I see our friend Ann Nyberg from WTNH is involved in the festival this year. So, folks, maybe you remember the Joy Luck Club. Art novelist Amy Tan is part of the program. Shelley, tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, she's not going to be talking about the Joy Luck Club, which is what most people think of in relation to her. Amy Tan, during the pandemic, wrote a book called the Backyard Book Chronicles, and it just came out in April. It's a combination of beautiful drawings that she did and narratives about these birds that she was watching in her backyard. You know, you were all stuck in the pandemic in our homes. And this is how Amy was passing time and spending time, and actually channeling a lot of the anti-Asian sentiment that was happening around the country and around the world into this artistic vehicle. And so she's going to come and talk to us about the Backyard Bird Chronicles in the brand new, newly remodeled Peabody Museum.
Yes,
that's going to be on June 18th. It is free, but you do need to reserve a spot.
Very good. A couple of programs that might be of greater interest to our BIPOC friends, and something I'm near and dear to, which is agriculture. And I'm thrilled that you're bringing in Farming While Black.
Yes. So this is Leah Penniman is really the star of this movie. Leah was awarded last year through the festival's Visionary Leadership event. We honored her and her work. She basically kind of brought back to life this large plot of land in upstate New York that was non-usable. And through farming techniques that she learned in West Africa, she was able to, and indigenous farming techniques, bring it back to really quite rich, fertile soil. So she founded a farm called Soul Fire Farm that teaches this farming practice. It is Black owned and Black run. And a documentary was made about her work. So the film is called Farming While Black. We are screening it for free at the Adante Student Center at Southern Connecticut State University. And we have the director of the film that's going to be joining us, Mark DeSena. He's done a ton of work in this space, as well as a panel of Black farmers from Connecticut. This is a movement is happening here in Connecticut on this work. And we wanted to make sure people heard about it. So that's happening May 21st. It's before the June festivities. It's part of our ramp up. Mm-hmm. And 6 p.m. on the 21st is when we'll be screening that, also free. And please make a reservation.
And I have to tell you, Shelley, I was so thrilled as I was wheeling through the massive list of activities and performers and guests for the festival to see not one, but two friends on the same bill. Our history-making state treasurer and my friend John Dankowski. I will let you, because I could talk about Eric Russell for, you know, essentially the rest of the 10 minutes. tell us what is appealing to you and the festival for bringing in our esteemed state treasurer and my friend Eric.
Absolutely. Well, you know, first of all, John, I'll start with John and say John is just such a fun person to listen to. Mm-hmm. And I think as an interviewer, he's so skilled and brings out stories that you wouldn't otherwise hear from his guests. So we're really excited to be working with John and Connecticut Mirror on this particular session. As you know, democracy and elected officials and, you know, all of this is very front of mind right now with the national election coming up in the fall. We have some really important voices at the state level that are kind of newly in politics or new in new positions. Eric's one of them.
Yes.
He is the first Black LGBTQ elected official.
Yes, constitutional at the state officer, treasurer. Yes.
Yes. And so so it's going to be both, you know, about his experience in politics, but I think also what's interesting is his personal journey through that role, that journey kind of to the office that he's in. what he sees as, in terms of what's coming, you know, so it'll be a little bit of a retrospective of his journey, but also of what's coming, you know, let's look forward. He's a newer voice, and a compelling voice and someone to really listen to as we chart the future of Connecticut.
Right. So a few great things are happening as a result of the timing of the festival. Juneteenth is happening right there in the middle of it. And the festival is also happening during Caribbean Heritage Month, which it prompts me to ask you to share how you are celebrating the festival with all these great community partnerships that we started talking about at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. The festival, I think, does some of its best. It does lots of things well. And one of the things I love that the festival does is collaborative programming. So there is a coalition, the Juneteenth official coalition of New Haven, that exists. It's led by Hanan Hameen and Iman Hameen. And they have been working with us for years. So we are kicking off. I think this might be the first time we're kicking off the festival with a Juneteenth celebration. The first Friday on the green will be Juneteenth programming on the stage. And that is being curated by the coalition, the New Haven Coalition for Juneteenth. The following day, so Saturday, so come on Friday and check that out. And then Saturday, there'll be a village, which I think is what most people are familiar with when it comes to Juneteenth programming and the festival. That's happening on the upper green, and it'll be all free. And then the end of the festival, so we're bookending with these really powerful connections. Mm-hmm. The last day of the festival is the day that we are celebrating Caribbean Heritage Month. And we are working with the Caribbean Heritage Festival of New Haven again, which we did last year. They also have a kind of a village setting that's going to be set up, but it's going to be all on the lower green this year. So a bunch of vendors, different tables that represent the different islands of the Caribbean with cultural artifacts and history and ways to connect. Food vendors, of course, where you can get, you know, all of your favorite Caribbean foods. And then we're going to end the evening with a fantastic performance. I can't say the name yet, but I can tell you it's going to be a Trinidad, an artist from Trinidad who's going to do soca music, which is what we had last year with Nicole Tasia. So it really has that carnival vibe, you know, very upbeat, very fun, very fast. Mm-hmm. We're going to make the green bounce again this year.
And ending our chat with a little mystery, which I like. I appreciate that, Shelley. Shelley Kiala is the executive director of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, putting New Haven and Connecticut on the global map once again, all these 29 years and counting and coming to New Haven. There's something every day happening on the street, in the venues, in the restaurants, in the lecture halls, in the museums of New Haven, June 14th through 29th. Artidea.org is the website you go for everything, parking information, travel information, ticketing, all that you need to know is at artidea.org. And Shelley, we will let you go because we know you're busy, and we thank you so much for taking time to speak with us again and orient us toward all the great stuff happening in New Haven for this festival this year. Appreciate it. As we mentioned in our introduction, we want to help you continue your healthful, mindful journey in your life, or perhaps introduce you to a way to make your life's journey more healthful and mindful through the practice of yoga. And we're so pleased to have early on developed a relationship with the Yoga in Our City movement. It began in 2012 in Hartford as part of a project called Civic Mind. Part of a project of an organization called Civic Mind, which was dedicated to social progress. We're going to invite you to be part of Yoga in Our City. Chances are free yoga is happening right down the street from you, wherever you are in Connecticut. We will be back to tell you all about it with our friend Lauren LaChance from Connecticut. We just want to remind you, though, if you're a woman business owner or entrepreneur ready to take things to the next level, you need to be part of the Women's Business Development Council. Maybe you've heard about them, maybe you've touched base with them before, but they want you to come learn about all of the resources they offer to small businesses, most of which are offered at no cost. You can join the Women's Business Development Council and find out how to get started. They've got something for individuals at all stages of business, entrepreneurial and financial education services, grants, promotional and community building opportunities, and so much more. This orientation that's coming up this Wednesday, May 15th at 10 a.m. is absolutely free. And you can get started by registering or find out about all of their program opportunities at ctwbdc.org for our friends at the Women's Business Development Council. All right, from women's business to taking care of your best self with yoga and the Yoga in Our City movement, Lauren LaChance, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So we've been talking about yoga in our city virtually since the beginning in 2012 and 13. Here we are now going on 14 years strong, and the movement in Connecticut has certainly grown. Where did your involvement with yoga in our city begin?
So Connecticut's involvement with yoga in our city was really from the inception of the program back in 2012. Our mission is to create healthier futures for residents across the state. So the partnership with Yoga in Our City was really a natural fit. Yoga provides so many opportunities for individuals to focus on their individual health journey in a really impactful way. So we really enjoy partnering with Yoga in Our City to be able to bring that opportunity to residents in a free and accessible way.
That's great. Now, in terms of your involvement with the program, what can you tell us about the roots that Civic Mind contributed to this? How did it all begin?
So TJ Quench of Civic Mind, which is a community development organization, originally started this program only in the Hartford community in 2012. And due to his success, he has rapidly expanded the program with the help of partners like ourselves at Connecticare to several other cities, including Bridgeport, Waterbury, New London, New Haven, Willimantic. And now we are entering the community of Middletown, which is fantastic. And the classes are free. And he really started this program with the intention of making yoga accessible to the communities. And as he likes to say, our studio is our public parks.
Mm-hmm. So this has grown into quite a collaboration of members, volunteer teachers, and partners driven to build a culture of community connection and well-being. Can you talk a little bit about the partners? We don't really recognize them or hear enough about them, because there's a lot of people or at least a few individuals and organizations that kind of work quietly behind the scenes. But Yoga in Our City here in Connecticut wouldn't have grown into the program it is in this year in 2024 without the engagement of a number of other important entities. Tell us a little about those partnerships.
Yeah, of course. So first, I'd love to mention all of our teachers are from the communities where they teach, and they all have their own backgrounds as to why they joined yoga. And they're really giving back to those communities by teaching through Yoga in Our City. And one of our most prominent partners is Mental Health Connecticut. They continue to encourage residents to join our classes and have been a strong partner of ours throughout the years. They incorporate our programming into all of their communication throughout the state. We also partner with the Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity. And they're an integral part in celebrating International Day of Yoga, which we host annually in Bushnell Park, which is a huge event that we do in June, where we bring the community together to encourage them to try yoga with their family and friends. They also help us bring more light to the program with our elected officials, who continue to be strong partners of ours across the state. And then the past couple of years, we've also been partnering with the Hartford Yard Goats, We've been offering multiple classes at Duncan Park on Saturday mornings, and we've seen upwards of 100 people attend those classes. It's a great way to see the park, spend a Saturday morning. A lot of people who attend ride their bike or walk in. So those are just three of our partners that have joined us over the years. We are very thankful for them.
Well, having touched in excess of 15,000 people since 2012 and bringing over 600 classes each year to this growing network of parks and cities in Connecticut, this organization and this movement, it really looks like it's going strong. Let's talk a little bit more about the benefits of yoga, and especially to those who may have never tried it before, or maybe even were in a situation where they kind of jumped right into it without a lot of background knowledge, and maybe got into an introductory situation where they were surrounded by a lot of other people with a lot more experience and may have gotten a little bit intimidated or discouraged because everyone else seemed to be so much further along than them. I mean, what impressed me most learning about yoga in our city was its attraction to newcomers.
Yeah. You know, I think when you first think about yoga, to your point, John, it can be a little intimidating. My first thought was always, oh, I'm not flexible enough to practice yoga. But really, yoga has so many great health benefits. It can be practiced at any age and any ability level. So just some of the benefits are, you know, they strengthen your heart health and your cognitive health. It can also just help reduce stress. There's a really beautiful way to practice breathing in yoga, just to help reduce stress and anxiety in our everyday lives. And it can also result in better sleep. And then one of the most important things is as we age, balance becomes key. And yoga really helps us practice that balance in a very low impactful way. So really it can benefit the entire body. And in addition to the physical benefits, there are a lot of mental health benefits to that as well. And as I mentioned, it does help reduce stress. It can help you just slow down your thoughts after a busy day. And it can also just help you think better. So there's just so many benefits for the entire body. We really do encourage people to come as they are. You can be a first timer or a 10-year yogi veteran. Our instructors provide hands-on instruction, and they also provide a lot of different ways that you can do positions. So you really can listen to your body and practice at your own speed. You don't need anything to attend class. You just show up in whatever you feel most comfortable in, with a blanket, a towel, or a mat, and you can practice at your own pace. We've seen people come with their children. We've seen coworkers come together, and it's a really great way to bring the community together as well.
Yeah, and you've extolled the wonderful qualities of the many teachers that have come on board to conduct this growing movement of yoga in our city classes. But there's still hundreds and hundreds of yoga instructors or those who could be yoga instructors who are out there who may love the opportunity to get the exposure that they might have to such a diverse audience of students. And to that end, you offer yoga teacher training as well, right?
Yes. Yoga in our city recently started Happy Warrior Training, and they take instructors right from our community, and they teach them how to be not only a good social citizen, but how to be a welcoming teacher that will eventually teach in the Yoga in our city program. And I believe right now they have their first class going through, and I believe that they graduate this month. So we may see some new faces as instructors in parks across the state this year, and we are very excited to welcome them.
The other important part about being able to maintain a good program of yoga practice is not losing the connection of and the inspiration of either the instructors or the peers. And I remember talking about yoga in our city and how it was happening and still working so hard to be successful during the COVID era. And that's really when the strength of the video component came out. And now, a couple years on, you guys have built a great kind of inventory of like YouTube type programming that people can go to even when it's pouring rain out or stifling hot and you don't want to go out necessarily and practice your yoga outside, or you can't make a particular yoga in our city lesson on a particular day. You can still find sort of that virtual friendship and inspiration through the video programs.
Yes, we do have a virtual studio. In the winter, we do upload new videos quite often. They range from 15-minute practices to just a basic run-through for somebody who'd like to just start their day with yoga. And to your point as well, when we do cancel classes due to inclement weather, which does happen in the summer months, we do encourage people to take a class from home, from the comfort of their home when it's pouring rain. It is a great resource. Our instructors have taken the time to record those videos and provide them to the public. And it's a great resource. We do, during COVID, we really pushed to have those videos so that people could get that physical and mental benefit of yoga, even when we couldn't come together as a community in the parks.
Looking toward the future, are you poised to begin posting a schedule of classes?
Yes, we are launching our schedule in the next week or so. Our first classes begin on May 18th and they go through mid-October. As we've seen, it stays pretty warm through the fall months. So from feedback from participants, we have extended the program into the fall, and we will be sharing those schedules on our social media platforms. Our handles are Yoga in Our City, and also on our website, yogainourcity.com. And we also have a newsletter that provides updates on new classes that will be added to the schedule, upcoming events that Yoga in Our City is participating in. And also we provide different health and wellness tips and blogs. The newsletter too is a great resource.
Starting as a small weekly program to build a happier, healthier Hartford in 2012, Yoga in Our City has, as you've heard, grown into a movement in many Connecticut cities. There's probably a yoga class in your city, perhaps right down the street from you at a park you're familiar with. Why not take advantage of beginning this program or bolstering your yoga practice or reinvigorating one that has elapsed by getting involved in Yoga in Our City? Their worthy spokesperson for the close of our program this morning is Lauren LaChance. Lauren, thank you for representing Yoga in Our City in Connecticut so well. We really appreciate your time, and we'll see you at your time. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.